Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Civ CEO 5 by Andrew Karavik. Narrated by Neil Heligers. Chapter 1. Back in the old world, my grandfather was a homesteader. He, along with many other men and women, gathered along a line in Oklahoma, stake in hand. A man with a gun stood by the wayside. When the gun fired, everyone would rush to stake their claims on the vast swaths of land that went untilled. Whatever land he staked, if he worked for 5 years and made something of it, he would be allowed to keep it. That was the start of the Morris lineage, a man making a mad dash to grab as much land as he could, not for his own devices, but for the great family he wanted to build. Today, as I stared at the great valleys of South Lyora, I could not help but feel as if I were walking in his footsteps. The perpetual thorn in my side, the evil tradesman organization, had finally been destroyed. The powerful magic that allowed them to reign and rule shattered when their headquarters were destroyed, and now there was nothing to rule over Lyora. No kings, no monopolies, just champions who'd been handed stakes of their own. The rules of the game had changed. Perhaps for the first time in most champions' lives. All neutral territory was free to be grabbed by any champion who could send settlers first. There was a heavy underlying threat behind this mad dash for land. If any territory remained neutral by the end of next spring, a new faction would arise to replace the tradesmen. The champions would find themselves once again beholden to powers that control their actions and their trading habits. No one wanted to return to that horrid way of life. And so, all across Lyora, new territories were being created. Large chunks of land became the color of new borders, and my own nation, Tyne, was no different. We had seized almost all of South Lyora in a crazed push to ensure that no one could get their borders even close to Tyne. The beaches were mine, the valleys and hills of the west, mine as well. I took too much territory, far more than I could possibly manage, because while everyone else was in a rush to grab land for their own nation, my plan was different. I intended to get a hold on real estate and then sell it to those who would agree to permanent alliances. "That's the last unit," my civics advisor, Ferlin, said to me as we watched the large caravan of men and women suddenly disappear. Replacing them was the wooden foundation of a town. The settler unit had finally reached the assigned spot. I now controlled 90% of South Lyora. The blue borders surrounded every other nation to the south, giving somewhat of a wide berth to some of my closer allies, of course. "How big are we total?" I asked, glancing at my charts. With the growing complexity of my work as champion of Tyne, I was growing far more reliant on my advisors to give me information, as keeping track of these things was hard enough already.
150,000 square miles, sir," Ferlin replied, pushing up his spectacles. "Far more than we could ever possibly manage. You're going to lose a lot of territory once summer gets here."
My cohort was, of course, referring to the traditional season in which champions went to war. Spring was for planting, summer for war, fall for harvest, and winter for almost freezing to death. This was the perpetual cycle of Lyora, and in my short time of being in this land, I was beginning to grow used to it. "Doubtful," I said, eyeing King Adisa's own territory. His purple borders in the north had grown wider for a brief time, but an unfortunate military action from a nearby champion forced him to cease all expansion, locking him into several months of conflict. By the time the dust had settled, my newfound ally discovered that he had lost out on the chance to grab the land nearest to him. His little kingdom was surrounded by great borders of various powers, and no doubt this made him nervous. Nervous enough to spend a vast fortune on land next to a very friendly territory. My plan was simple. I would secure 3 or 4 great allies to enter into a permanent alliance with, drafting up a defense contract that would ensure that all parties joined together for the common good. This union would become the foundation for my new nation's independence, for if I were surrounded by allies, anyone who wished to invade me would have to go through them first, and a defense pact between all parties meant that attacking a single nation would invoke the ire of all. I was, in a sense, trying to create NATO from my own world, a military pact where all parties would defend one another. However, there were going to be some rules that would be necessary if we were going to be able to live in peace and prosperity.
I was not about to try and create a world power that would interfere in the rest of Liora. Aggressive military action would be strictly forbidden. All wars would be defensive. Squabbles between parties within this coalition would be resolved by an independent court, which would be managed by the Rabbitans. They were foreigners with a long cultural history of magistrates and judges who ruled with neutrality and utmost adherence to the written laws. Their power would even be out of my hands to ensure this coalition was truly beneficial to all. All in all, I was excited with our progress. Winter was just around the corner, which was a time for contemplation and reflection. My own cities, Tyne, Reed, and Brightwinds, were well taken care of during the winter. East Hill, my newest full city, wasn't my own concern, for the mighty dragon Gly was the governor. As part of our arrangements, Gly would provide me great services in times of trouble, and she would be allowed to rule East Hill without oversight from me. And indeed, the moment I had assigned her as governor, she no longer spoke to me. But the little city was growing by the day, and I was confident they would do well during the winter. At the very least, she could use her great fire to keep everyone warm and safe. The rest of the settlements scattered across Liora were simply homesteaders, a cheaper and smaller type of settler that simply extended my borders. Homesteaders worked off the land and produced their own food. During the winter, they would return to the warm halls of Tyne or even Reed, but come spring, they would be right back, tending to the land until it was time for me to place a city on it. With the coming of the new season, it was time for me to begin anew. No longer was I forced to react to endless threat after threat from the tradesmen. Now, I was in the driver's seat. I was in total control. There were no great threats. There was no danger. All I had were opportunities. Opportunities to turn South Liora into a powerful nation on its own. One that would contend with the great nations from my own homeland. All I needed was the right people to invite into my coalition. But frankly, that was far easier said than done. Chapter 2. Wealth was no longer a priority for my nation. With the downfall of the treaties, there came 100 contracts rushing to my inbox, begging to get the best rates for goods such as sugar, spices, and herbs from afar. My wagons began to work overtime to fulfill these orders, importing them from the city of Liscoa through the use of my teleportation gate. By the time I had grabbed all the land I could get my hands on, my coffers were loaded, filled to the brim with coins from all champions near and far. But wealth without security is little more than a target. Just as banks have great vaults and armed men to ensure no one can take from them, so must a nation be able to defend itself. With my income projected to reach its first million through champion contracts alone by the end of the year, I had a great need to secure myself. There were, of course, the most basic actions that needed to be done. Better walls were erected around Tyne, made of tall stone that could resist the most powerful of artillery fire. Brightwinds, too, had a wall, made of basalt, and meant to protect it from the rest of the world. Reed, a relatively small village compared to Tyne, also clamored for such a construction, and so I had paid to begin erecting defenses for them as well. Military outposts were built, guard towers to house archers, and road checkpoints were given a much-needed upgrade from wood to stone. But when it came to the question of building a standing military, I ran the numbers enough times to know that to sufficiently defend the wealth that I had, I would be forced to spend almost all of that wealth. With the creation of these new borders, it was easy for me to see just how big certain champions really were. Harald, a friendly party, had marched towards the north and carved such a large chunk of territory that the only thing that could stop him was an equally big contender, known only as the Silent One, a woman who never spoke. Her actions were far louder than anything she could say, for she had grabbed more territory than any other champion on the map. When her massive army of silent soldiers with skin of stone arrived to a territory that wasn't hers, she would take it by force. King Adisa's allies had lost a great deal of men to her forces and eventually gave up their claims and dissolved their coalition, leaving her to grow even greater. While I knew that Harald would never turn on me, for our friendship was great, I could not be sure that he would stand in the way of the Silent One. At her last meeting for our shipping company, of which Harold was a member, he fawned over her publicly and declared his love for her, despite the fact that he had never spoken to the woman. With that kind of admiration, it would not be hard to imagine him stepping aside and letting her army march on Tyne. Her borders were growing closer each day, and no doubt she would notice the many caravans heading towards me, filled with gold. And if not her, there would be some other danger coming down the pipeline. Peace was the perfect time for me to build up my strength, but war was not my strong point. My best option was to outsource any conflict to this new coalition that I was building, and in order to do that, I would need to find the right candidates and convince them to buy my territory. Harold was out. Simply put, the man, while powerful in his own right, would never stop fighting. His attitude towards war was casual, and I'd seen him get into 3 separate conflicts at the same time purely because he had grown bored sitting at home in his castle. Despite the fact that he won all 3 of those fights, I was not interested in taking him on as a permanent ally. His propensity for making enemies was the opposite of what I was trying to accomplish. Our mission would be peace through prosperity. Harold's slogan was war for war's sake. The rest of my allies were pleasant but weak. Most of southern Lyora had been crippled by the tradesmen's stranglehold, and prosperity had fled from them. They were beginning to grow in their own right, but unfortunately, my sheer size was stifling them. I received more than 1 complaint from Lady Elmira about my land grab, but she did not have the military or economic force to threaten any kind of reprisal. I would take care of my trade allies, of course, for if South Lyora was secure, we would all prosper, but I was under no obligation to give handouts to anyone, especially when she had been so shrewd in previous dealings with me. King Edisa was my first choice, and I knew that if things continued to go poorly for him in the north, getting him to relocate wouldn't be much trouble. Stationing him in the south would create a buffer between him and my trade partners, as well as cover our flanks in case anyone attempted to invade via ocean. The beaches were wide, and while Brightwinds controlled a significant portion of the ocean front, the fact was I couldn't prevent enemy ships from landing in the south. If a force wanted to attack me from behind, I was quite vulnerable. But Edisa's position in this new coalition was a consideration for the great sacrifices he had made in our newfound friendship, as well as his aid in ending the tradesmen. He had played a vital role in defeating them, and that needed to be rewarded. My ever-growing wealth was in part due to him. I could not stand by and watch him lose everything, especially considering the fact that these conflicts started due to the aftermath of the tradesmen vanishing. For the north and west, however, I needed real powers, strong ones who were interested in what I had to offer. I had set my eye on 2 targets already. In the far, far west, past Harold's ever-expanding borders, there was an emperor who is said to reign in the mountains, with great underground tunnels leading to secret places all throughout Lyora. Emperor Glowmill, as he was called, had a reputation for a fierce army that could defend their territory with ease. But the man never went to war. Whatever his business was, it was far more important than conquest. Upon the dissolution of the tradesmen, Glowmill sent me 2 caravans filled with beer, meats, and cheeses as a gift. Included in one of the baskets was a letter with a series of requests, all of which I could fulfill with ease. A trade relationship had been struck, but I never really heard anything from him. He kept to himself. That was something I was looking for. An expansive empire that was peaceful and respectful enough to send gifts before trade. My next choice was an old power in the north, Lady Hiscus of Radagar. As an established champion, Lady Hiscus erected a cathedral almost directly in the center of Lyora and took up residency there, slowly building works and wonders to honor her patron deity, Viol. As fortune would have it, Viol was also my patron, and we had recently finished the construction of a citadel, one that honored the goddess of music and culture. Lady Hiscus's territory was small, yes, but she exclusively recruited cleric adventurers and paladins, who had to this day successfully defended the cathedral chock full of treasure from all invaders. One famed story involved the whole of a nation marching their army on the footstep of the cathedral and demanding surrender. 14 clerics joined hands in response to this and sang a song that simply caused the army to fade away. Where they went? No one knows to this day. The only trouble with Miss Hiscus was the fact that she didn't appear to be ambitious. She was content to run her cathedral and her elite units, but never did much of anything. Perhaps if I offered her stewardship over the citadel, she would be motivated to join me and lounge around to the north, where clerics could make the Silent One's inevitable army disappear. All in all, my work was cut out for me. There were others to visit, but these two were on the top of my list. Both were friendly for one reason or another, and both were powerful in their own right. The only question that I needed to know was what they wanted. At the end of the day, it would all come down to a trade. Everyone needed something, and I was gaining the reputation for being the exact man for facilitating any kind of deal. I just hoped that they both needed something that I could provide. Chapter 3. With my eyes on the map of the great picture, looking at the constant territory changes, my caravan departed for Mount Gimli, the home of the great emperor. Coming along with me was my loyal retinue, Alamander the Illusionist, Knives, and Roost, my personal bodyguards, and of course Teresa, my diplomat advisor. "Something's off," Knives said as I stared at the map, watching more territory change to red, then to yellow, then back to red again. "I can feel it in the air. Something's not right." "Should we turn back around?" I asked, looking at my security advisor. The man had a sixth sense about these kinds of situations, and I had learned to trust him implicitly. He might not always make the decision that I liked, but he always made the right decision. "Not an ambush," Knives grunted. He opened the window to the carriage and stuck his head out. "Yep, that's not good." "What?" I asked, glancing out the window myself. Just as Knives had sensed, there was trouble ahead. An entire group of people was gathered at the first gate, the major checkpoint that controlled the crossroads to the west, the north, and the south. There was a mix of peasants, soldiers, and nobles standing around the gate, arms linked together. They were blocking the gate from opening, shoving their bodies against the two wooden barricades that allowed wagons passage. "The hell is this?" Knives grumbled as he climbed out of the vehicle. I heard him bark a few orders at the guards who were accompanying us on the trip to form a perimeter. I climbed out as well, looking at the motley crew of people. Were they protesters? They certainly weren't Tynish, that was for sure. Standing in front of this group was none other than Yusuf, Lady Almira, and Michelle Nguyen, the three champions for my trade arrangements. "Hold off on giving any orders," I said to Knives as I walked forward towards the trio. "I know these people." "I recognize them too," Knives replied. "Doesn't mean I'm not nervous." I ignored the man's protests, knowing full well that the three couldn't attack me due to our non-aggression pacts. Instead, it looked as if they had found a loophole to get my attention. I trudged along, wondering how to address this without causing further issues. It wasn't hard to guess the source of their anger. My land grab had been so fast that they had barely 100 miles between the three of them. "My greetings," I said, giving a hasty half-bow. Teresa, staggering out of the back of the caravan, apparently roused from a deep slumber, shuffled by my side to advise me in this matter.
"Save your greetings," Lady Almira said.
She was wearing a long, flowing white dress today, and it seemed to shimmer with a magical energy that made it just a little hard to focus on her, as if she were constantly moving, despite the fact that she was staying in place.
"You know why we're here."
"I have my guess," I replied, looking at all three. Yusuf, the magician king, didn't seem to be too thrilled to be here. There was a nervous energy about him, leading me to conclude that he had been swept up into this mess. Michelle of Aetherdome was also a bit hesitant, shrunk back with her shoulders low, indicating to me that she too wasn't taking charge. Lady Almira would appear to be the one who poisoned the barrel of apples. "Well," I said to Almira after a pause to size them up. I motioned with my hand to invite her to explain, offering no attempts to ease the tension. This little stunt was an annoyance. The roads were my property, but I had opened borders with all parties involved. These protesters could effectively bar the gate, for if I were to order my soldiers to remove them, it would be considered a violation of my non-aggression agreements. In other words, there were no rules preventing a huge chunk of people from standing in front of a gate, blocking it from opening.
You have greatly, and I mean greatly, offended us with your theft of our surrounding territories,
Elmira finally said, her voice shaking with a low-grade anger. I could see her fists clenching tightly as she spoke.
It is not enough that you already control a significant amount of territory in the south with three established cities. You've seen fit to mobilize your units and take land that should by all accounts be ours. Our complaints have gone unanswered, and now we are forced to resort to maneuvers to get you to acquiesce and return the land that should not be yours.
My borders were set to expand in a week, Michelle said.
Her voice was shaky, but she was far less angry than Lady Elmira. Rather, she kept her eyes on the ground as she talked.
And you literally snapped up every part where my borders would go. Etherdome leveled up, and my borders moved a half inch.
I myself am not prone to such protests, my friend, Yusuf said with a heavy sigh. The regret was most apparent on his face. But you have gotten too greedy too quickly. To go from dealing with us so even-handedly through trade and agreements to suddenly showing up on my front lawn, placing unit after unit to snap up the forests. It was a slap in my face.
I frowned at these complaints. These people were genuinely hurt by my actions. They were not here to shake me down, quite the opposite. They were here to get me to listen to reason, because in their minds, I was the one taking advantage of them. Everyone received the quest marker at the same time, I said. There was a clear call to adventure, and urgency was promoted. I understand you might look at my actions as treachery, but I was just playing the game. Same as you all would.
I would never dream about taking land close to you, Elmira replied, shaking her head. And then to ignore my letters? Even worse.
You have wronged us, Charles, Michelle weakly said. We all agree. That is why we're here.
I opened my mouth to tell her that they'd need to do better than send a bunch of peasants to lock arms to stop me, but quickly bit my tongue. Fortunately, Teresa anticipated that I would say something foolish and step forward.
It is most egregious that you have been ignored, she said with a bow, and I wish to apologize on behalf of Tyne. Tyne is standing right behind you, Elmira said, and we want him to apologize, not you.
I put a hand on Teresa's shoulder to pull her back. I got this, I murmured.
I will kill you,
she whispered back, and for a moment I wondered if I should call Knives for help. It would appear that she was on their side in this dispute as well. If I lost my own diplomat, clearly I was doing something wrong.
I fear that I did not consider how my actions looked, I said. From where I came from, when you hear the starting gun, you have to run as fast as you can and grab all you can get. I assumed everyone would do the same. That, I swear, was what governed my choice to take this land. There was no malicious intent, I promise.
Michelle softened up at that and nodded eagerly, but Lady Elmira crossed her arms.
And? She said.
And it would behoove us to draw borders that everyone finds agreeable, I said with a sigh, knowing full well I had lost this one. I was never going to hold on to all that territory for much longer anyway. I was just hoping to offload it on some stronger individuals.
See? Elmira said, turning to the other two. I told you, he's a busy man. You just have to get his...
Her words were interrupted as the point of a sword erupted from her chest, spraying blood everywhere. She gagged and stiffened, clutching the sword that impaled her, falling to the ground. Time seemed to slow down around me as I watched what happened. Lady Elmira fell to her knees and slumped over, motionless. Behind her was a man wearing a hood that covered his eyes. He was grinning, dagger in hand. I felt myself pointing and shouting to warn the others and could hear the sound of Knives and Roost charging forward in a frantic attempt to grab the man. The assassin merely stood still and grinned at me. With his free hand, he made a throat-cutting motion, then pointed at me before vanishing in a puff of smoke.
Time sped back up, and I heard the frantic screams of Michelle as she shoved her hands into the woman's wound, trying to stop the bleeding. Yusuf was standing over her, his face sunken. He was attempting a few spells at healing, but I could see by his expression that it was too late already. "The champion Elmira has fallen," the great picture said, a symbol of Olmec, her city, appearing. "Olmec has become neutral and reverted." Instantly, I could see her borders vanish and the level of the city reverted back to one. The walls, the buildings, the vast network of resource-gathering equipment she had built faded in seconds. There was nothing left but a tiny shell of a village. "I'm afraid she is gone," Knives said, kneeling down to check the woman, pulling the frantic, sobbing Michelle away. "A clean hit. Severed her heart instantly. She didn't suffer." "Hardly a comfort," Yusuf murmured. "To be cut down like that. She did not deserve this." I said nothing. I was still in shock. An assassination had taken place in broad daylight, in my territory, against the champion, against someone I considered a friend. And worse yet, that grin the assassin had seemed to indicate that this was far, far from over. Chapter 4. The 24 hours after Lady Elmira's assassination were pure chaos. Accusations were hurled left and right by all parties, including myself. Fingers were pointed, and by the end of it, our relationships had been irreparably harmed. Yusuf, seething with anger, believed that my lack of security was at fault and swore that he should repay me in kind for such carelessness. Michelle was far more understanding, but retreated home swiftly, to grieve the loss of a friend and to hide from the threat of the assassin returning. The body was left in my care. The interim high priest, Vinder, conducted a short ceremony and she was buried on a hill overlooking a beautiful valley. There was no one to attend her funeral as a friend, for with the destruction of her village, a great many people were displaced and forced to travel to Manathor to seek refuge behind Peter's walls. I did not know Elmira terribly well, but we got along well, and, well, she had been shrewd with me. I admired her. There was a shock and pain at the sudden loss, especially when I had been the one to save her life from a terrible disease so long ago. The fact that the end of her life was filled with a struggle with me over something so petty as land deeply grieved me. Perhaps out of guilt or as penance, I gave an excess of territory to Yusuf and Michelle almost immediately after the funeral. Yusuf returned the land just as quickly. He would not accept my paltry attempts at absolution. "It wasn't your fault, boss," Knives said as he sat with me on a hill, watching the sun go down. Vial funerals were held at sunset, so that their songs could carry the soul of the deceased along the brilliant light to usher them to their afterlife. I didn't quite know if there really was a hereafter, but the sentiment was comforting. "That guy was a pro. I didn't want to mention it in front of the others, but I know him." I tilted my head up at that and looked at him. "What?" "Champion killers are rare, because you get cursed if you do it. Like, literally everything in your life turns to ash. So there's only one kind of man who would commit such a crime. A man who's already been cursed, and I only know one who was a knife for hire. We served together during a few clandestine operations a few years ago. I'd recognize that hood anywhere." A shiver ran down my spine as I remembered the fiendish grin the assassin had worn as he pointed at me, indicating that I was next on his list. A man already condemned had nothing left to lose. "You said he was hired," I replied after a moment. "Any idea who would want to kill someone like Elmira? She was harmless to the rest of the world." "If you're alive, someone out there wants you dead," Knives curtly replied. "Either as a lark or because they hate you, or maybe because you were in the way of someone getting what they wanted. But I should warn you, boss. Things are going to get rough for a while. Everyone knows when a champion is killed, it gets people on edge,
you're going to have a hell of a time making friends until people aren't watching their backs anymore.
An assassination of a champion on my land, I said, shaking my head. Such a disgrace. Why didn't I have better security?
You want the comforting answer, or the real one?
Knives asked, crossing his arms. He looked at me curtly, clearly.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?